just for you, my love.
The Serpentine Podcast on Work.
This is episode 5 of the Serpentine Podcast on Work. I'm your host, Victoria Sin, back in the studio with Lucia Pietro-Justi.
Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Lucia.
How are you feeling? You're cradling a hot water bottle.
I'm a little bit ill. I wasn't sure if I was going to make it last night, but this morning I steamed myself and, you know, sometimes when you're ill, you still have to work.
Well, I feel bad that you're here instead of taking care of yourself, but it would have been terribly lonely here. Quite glad you're here.
Yeah, you know, I feel good. I feel good about being here too now.
Did you get that ill because you worked so hard at the marathon?
You know, I want to blame it on the marathon, but it was my flatmate.
By the way, last episode, your backstage chat at the marathon itself, yes, were amazing.
Oh, thank you.
They were so good.
I really enjoyed doing them. It was nice to kind of like ask people on kind of like a macro level, like, what do you think the most undervalued form of work is? And then to kind of get in personal and be like, what is the most undervalued form of work you do? That often caught people by surprise.
Actually, like, if you were asking yourself those two questions, would the answer be the same? Like, what is the most undervalued form of work?
Gosh, I don't know. I think it's so hard because there are so many different forms of work. I think, see, now you've caught me by surprise. I think, yeah, the most undervalued form of work that I do is, I think, emotional labor. Mm-hmm. But I think within the episode, I would have to agree, you know, with most of the people that I asked, that the most undervalued form of labor is probably domestic work. And that is work that's often performed by migrant communities and women, and it's often paid very little or nothing at all.
And involving, as it does, care work, it obviously has an element of, yes, emotional labor.
Yes.
Also,
definitely.
Even if it's just the performance of emotional labor.
Mm-hmm.
But in a certain sense, I was thinking about this coming here today. It just struck me that sometimes, like, artists do that through the work. Like, I came to see your performance, obviously, and at the Serpentine, and it struck me that you sort of took on board a lot of the emotional work almost on behalf of the audience or something. Like, yeah. I mean, I suppose it's a really old notion of catharsis, but in a way, can one sort of think of artists' labor or work as care work also?
Definitely, but that's like a big thing in my work, is like using this tool of like drag and of like storytelling to perform emotional labor, but in a way that where it becomes recognized, to use it to kind of like seduce people into the narrative and turn it into something that is like being not only recognized, but like held up and, you know, like respected. For the next two episodes, we'll be sharing some of the material recorded at the Serpentine Work Marathon, which took place at the Royal Geographical Society on September 22, 2018. Today, we're talking about artwork, or the work of art. And this is something that's going to come up in this next talk by Daniel Ross, the relationship between like knowledge and artwork, and how artists can use knowledge to kind of like transform. Daniel Ross is a philosopher and co-director of an award-winning documentary based on the works of Martin Heidegger. He's also the author of Violent Democracy, which proposes that violence is an integral part of the democratic system.
What is the function of art? This is an anthropological question, but we shouldn't be too quick to assume that we really know what anthropology is. If we look into anthropology, we see that the question of art is not originally a matter of art objects in isolation, but always connected to rituals. Art objects are always involved in rituals, and rituals always involve art objects. So what are these rituals? Rituals are always a question of a kind of a transformation of a situation. whether it's a ritual to reinforce and to produce the sense of community, or a ritual in preparation for a war to produce the sense of martial connectedness against another enemy, or a courtship ritual that is to transform the situation between two individuals. Always a ritual involves a question of transformation. And this is the work that art does in rituals. In fact, I think the reason to introduce the question this way is because art and work and knowledge are always really the same question. How so? So if I say that it's to transform a situation, what do I mean? It's that to renegotiate or to produce or invent a situation between different orders of magnitude in a locality. In a courtship ritual, you have two localities. I am a locality, or I and my smartphone am a locality, I am my house. And to transform that into a larger locality, which is a couple, a family, and so on. And in the same case of a ritual that is to give the sense of community to a group of separate individuals, this is a transformation in relation to renegotiating orders of magnitude. But on what basis can rituals and the art objects involved in rituals do this? They do it through a criterion. The criterion is something in which you believe, something cosmological, something higher, that enables you to say how to reassign these orders of magnitude. Another way to say that is what John Austin, the philosopher of speech acts, described. In particular, the most famous case is when a priest performs the ritual that turns two separate individuals into a husband and a wife. It's called performativity. In doing it, he creates it. He transforms the situation. And according to John Austin, this transformation, the possibility of this transformation, depends on institutional conditions. I cannot do it. Only the priest can do it because he is invested with the authority to do it by the institutions that give him the artistic power involved in that ritual. And because it's dependent on these institutional conditions, we tend to think of this as conservative, because an institution is a structure. But what really is an institution? An institution itself is something that only exists as long as we believe in it. Like this, the institution involved in the Serpentine Gallery exists only as long as we believe that it's really there. And so this question of the criterion continues to apply. Performativity applies to the institution itself. What this means is that how we should really understand the question of the institution, the question of the ritual, is in terms of the knowledge that's required in order to be able to enact this correctly. But this correctness depends on this higher criterion, the cosmological criterion. And so, of course, we modern people immediately think, but in all these hundreds of tribes and ethnicities and societies, they all have a different higher criterion. So they must all be wrong. How can they be right? But in fact, what we believe in terms of knowledge is always something that doesn't exist. For instance, in geometry, the foundation of geometry is the point and the line. These do not exist. Where is the point? Where is the line? But we believe in them, and on the basis of that belief, we construct a form of knowledge that lasts and lasts across many generations. So in art conceived in this anthropological way, Knowledge is crucial. Crucial in terms of the ability to produce instruments and the ability to know how to use those instruments to transform a situation in relation to a higher criterion. Now, in the history of art, as we've heard about many things, everything changes. There is always acceleration, there is always disruption, and there are always bifurcations, positive and negative. Two disruptions in particular occur in the history of art. One is firstly when it becomes separated from the question of ritual, when it becomes separated from rituals. And then the art object starts to become not a cosmological object, but something that is judged on the basis of a different criterion, the criterion of beauty. And this is the beginning of classical art. It begins in Greece, this criterion of beauty, and yet this was still a culture that was a ritual culture and a tragic culture. Then a second bifurcation, a second disruption in the history of art occurs with industrialization. The birth of modern art begins as a response to this industrialization, as an attempt to question and to negotiate and to transform the situation that arose with the beginning of industrial products. But at the same time, art begins itself to become involved in this industrial process. And in the 20th century, we can see how far this goes through the birth of what becomes the culture industry, in the terms of Adorno. In this case, art retreats from the culture industry. But what is its criterion? It's no longer something cosmological. It's no longer beauty. Modern art struggles to find what is the criterion, or it rejects the notion of something higher on which to make such judgments. But in such rejection, what tends to happen is a loss of the sense of what kind of knowledge is really involved with art, what its function really is. Now, I wanted to mention one work of art. I'm conscious of time. In 1955, the great Japanese director, Akira Kurosawa, made a film in response to a situation that was changed by acceleration. In 1945, of course, Hiroshima suffered the detonation of the atomic bomb. But less than 10 years later, on the Bikini Atoll, were atomic explosions that were not fission, but fusion explosions, hydrogen explosions, 1,000 times more powerful. This is acceleration. And this was an acceleration that caused great fear among the Japanese people. And Kurosawa decided to make a film about this, which is known in English as I Live in Fear. The story is about a man who is very concerned about the possibility of fallout from nuclear explosions. He wants to move. And all around him, he sees people continuing on with their lives, and he cannot understand how this is possible. Somebody says to him, "Why are you so afraid?" And he says, "I'm not afraid. To be afraid is to run away from a problem rather than to confront it. This is a question of courage. In fact, it's very ambiguous. Is he courageous or is he mad?" But what the film is really about is denial, the possibility of continuing on as if you don't know something that you do know. So the question of knowledge arises here as that which needs to be discovered, uncovered. In the film, eventually he goes mad. and he is in an insane asylum. And the psychiatrist says, this patient is melancholic, but he makes me feel melancholic. And this is the question of denial, of the consequences of denial. And Kurosawa's attitude towards this film, which was his least successful film, was that this was a film that mattered. This was a film that at the end of the day, at the end of his life, he and those who made the film would be able to say, we made this film. Why? Because this was a film that was about discovering, uncovering knowledge that was there, the knowledge of that which there was to be not afraid of, but to have fear about. Today we live with this kind of denial all the time, but no longer in relation to atomic explosions so much, it's still there, but in relation to, firstly, the destruction of the biosphere that we've heard very much about, but secondly, there's another kind of denial. The question of entropy is not just the question of thermodynamic entropy. That means that we are destroying diversity in biology. It's also the question of the destruction of knowledge itself. And therefore, the destruction of the question of the possibility of doing art itself. So what then is the function of art? Who then is an artist today if to be an artist is not just to draw attention to an issue, but to uncover the knowledge that is necessary to transform a situation? It's in this sense that I think we need to understand Beuys's statement that everyone is an artist.
Okay, so that was a really interesting viewpoint on art and kind of unusual in the contemporary art kind of discourse.
Definitely.
What did you think?
I was interested in this idea of, you know, like going back to before art kind of had no criterion, where art was used in rituals as kind of a transformative vehicle. Mm-hmm. I think I relate to that a lot in my work because I'm always trying to transform and transport people to kind of like a little secret world.
Well, that's really interesting in the context of what Daniel Ross talked about as performativity, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when he was talking about John Austin and speech acts and a priest who, when he says, I pronounce you man and wife, he's at the same time doing it. Of course, you know, I have to think about performativity and Judith Butler and how that works with gender. You know, when a baby is born, you say it's a boy or it's a girl, and that's also, you know, the act that makes that true and does it.
Right.
So, yeah, I definitely am interested in how art can transform in that way as well. But it's very complicated. Like, I think Daniel Ross is talking about belief systems when he talks about institutions and mm-hmm. how the institution exists because, you know, we all believe in it. So what I got from the talk was maybe that, like, the role of the artist is to, like, gather the knowledge to kind of, like, change people's minds about current belief systems.
Right. He did talk about it in terms of, like, uncovering things that are perhaps too complex or too awful to sort of feel. I do feel it's something that's coming up quite a bit in this project around ecology that I've been working on at the mm-hmm. Serpentine, because often when you sort of bring together scientists and artists, the first thing the scientists tend to say is, oh, that's great because we need people to make the things that we're researching or the things that we're finding exciting for the public. So it has this kind of, in science's mind, and I don't mean every scientist, but in science's mind, art is this kind of public relations exercise, as
a vehicle.
Exactly.
Yeah, where it's not.
Whereas maybe what we've been interested in this project has been this idea of how can an artist or an artwork change the direction of scientific research itself, mm-hmm. like do things.
Mm-hmm.
There's this other thing that we keep sort of bouncing around talking about this idea of deep time politics and like what a deep time politics kind of could be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some artworks work in the kind of present time, present moment, things that have to do with policy, things that have to do with sort of politics in this precise moment.
Yeah.
But if you think about like, oh, a technological object now, like, isn't it funny that it looks just like sci-fi 40 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of think, well, either the sci-fi writers of 40 years ago were visionaries and like saw it coming.
Right.
Or the people that are making technology now are making it in the shape that they were reading when they were kids.
Yeah.
And so
I
this
think that's
idea,
definitely true.
Right. So this idea of deep time politics is like, how can you put something in the world that maybe will change even like a tiny little thing like in 40 years? So maybe you don't see the function of art.
Right. I think I disagreed a little bit with the role of the artist to use knowledge to transform, of that being like a new criterion. Like, I think like the point of art is that there is no criterion, so you see what happens when there's no rules.
Right.
Next, we're sharing a discussion hosted by John Gray with artist Lynette Yadom-Boarchi and architect Sir David Ajay. John Gray is the co-founder of Ghetto Gastro, a culinary collective and cultural movement based in the Bronx that explores the intersection of food, design, and community empowerment. Lynette Yadom-Boarchi is a figurative painter whose oil paintings focus on figures that exist outside of a specific time and place. She was shortlisted for the Turner Prize in 2013. Sir David Ajay founded architecture firm Ajay Associates in 2000. They have completed work in Europe, North America, the Middle East, Asia, and Africa, including the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, the Moscow School of Management, and the Nobel Peace Center in Oslo. The first voice you'll hear is John's.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
First and foremost, I want to just give a shout out to my heroes and friends for doing this with me, and we couldn't resist the temptation to do a Janet Jackson, Rhythm Nation microphone kind of conversation. So we're here to talk about work. In my past, work has meant many things, from packing bags in more than one type of way, to playing basketball, to cooking food, washing dishes, etc. So I want to get an understanding from you, Lynette, like being first generation here in London, what was it like with your family when you went to art school, and if they ever considered that work to this day, or what did it take for them to have that understanding, like, oh, this is work, or this is working?
I'm still waiting, actually, to some extent. No, that's not true. I think coming here in the 60s, as my parents did, moving here from Ghana, there was always this strong sense within my family unit that work was survival. So you did what you needed to do. And my parents trained as nurses in Ghana and were part of that wave of people sort of pretty much invited here to do the jobs that nobody wanted to do here. So as nurses, they worked a kind of crazy schedule to make ends meet with the family. So I don't think there was ever a point where I really said, I'm going to be an artist, because they would have been quite horrified and terrified by the concept. But as I moved through education and it became sort of like a likelihood that I would continue with this, I had to handle it quite softly. There was never a point where I could say, this is going to be my work, because I think the anxiety that would have caused them would have maybe been too much. So I can't say I ever planned to do this. I can't say it's a career that you can plan. It's a career you sort of, you survive through, you make a way through, you find a way through. There's no one way of doing it. And so for me, work was always survival and the compulsion to do, the compulsion to get through to the next step. There was never any planning involved apart from the next step.
Copy. How about you, Sir David?
No, sirs. work is, I mean, I think Lynette's sort of description of the relationship to, you know, first generation families is probably quite universal, in the sense that, you know, for all our parents, it was about, you know, that education was emancipation and freedom. You know, it was the kind of a way to get to a life where you were in control. And for me, the concept of work was to finally have control. Not control as in wanting to kind of set things up, but control in the sense of being able to be who I wanted to be in the world. So for me, when I discovered architecture was a kind of way for me to creatively express myself. You know, up to that point, I thought I wanted to be a doctor, a scientist. You know, it was like chasing, my brothers were doing other things. And I thought that maybe that was what it was about. But when I discovered that creativity was kind of ultimately what kind of fueled my passion for life, it was impossible to go back. And it transcended from being this notion of work that was a translation of my parents' generation to being a kind of an idea of, oh, this is what living is about. You know, because for me, the biggest fear was to not find why I was living. I think that's my biggest fear.
And was there any particular project or moment where what you chose as your path resonated with your parental unit? Were they like, oh, okay.
No.
No. I mean, I think the closest I could get was a really bizarre moment when I was at the RA. And this didn't by any means set their minds at rest, but I was selected for, it's going to sound really strange, but basically I was asked to meet the Queen, which for me wasn't really, I mean, I wasn't really that concerned about that, but like there was money involved, like quite a substantial amount of money. It was an award. It's like I've been given an award. And I don't know, I think it was almost like, oh, the Queen. This is serious. This stuff is, you know, maybe this thing has legs. You know, maybe this is... Because they were less, weirdly, they were less concerned about them. I was like, money. I was broke. But that was, I think, a moment where they were like, huh. Because I think part of that sense was always that one thing I was always taught was that we would have to be, in some ways, three times as good to get half as far. So with that in mind, there was always a feeling that the choice of work, that's why, as David was saying, you know, doctor, lawyer, pick something solid, pick something that you can't kind of, can't go wrong with. You can always get work, you can always do something. And so this sense of feeling safe or feeling like we'd chosen something safe was the important thing. And I don't think the fear or the concern or the concern for us ever really goes away. It's just like, okay, make sure you can survive. If this doesn't work out, make sure you've got a plan B and make sure there's, you know, another way. So yeah, the Queen, I guess.
Okay. It's funny because mine was like when we did a project with Martha Stewart and my mom was like, okay, I guess this is not just a game, you know?
It's a kind of similar thing, you know, prominent, you know, woman. Queen, Martha Stewart.
And it's wild because it's like, you know, all of these things traveling the world, like, it's always interesting to see the thing that resonates with them when they're like, oh, okay, you're not, like, just playing around. It's not a phase, you know?
Yeah.
And I want to use that to segue in talking about the current state of affairs as far as media and sharing of work. And although you both do beautiful projects and make beautiful things, you don't use your social media platforms to share your personal work. So I want to kind of understand the thoughts behind that.
Well, that's kind of interesting because actually I think I do, but I don't share what people think that I should share, which is the production of The Office necessarily. But I share like the most intimate thing for me, which is my personal observations. They are very real and it's done by me. There's no sort of comms person doing it. Mm-hmm. I think that was probably the most generous way I could be with what my personal kind of reflections are, because in a way my biggest thing is constantly looking for inspiration and looking for things that stimulate me. And I could show what I'm doing as production, but that's sort of just, it will eventually come out. The kind of most intimate thing that won't come out, maybe comes out when you're dead if anybody cares, is the things that inspired you. You know, the idea that somehow social media allows this kind of one-on-one engagement with the entire planet that has access to the technology seemed very beautiful as a way to just say, I was here and this was a really powerful image for me, or this was a really powerful kind of moment. I don't share myself as a, I don't have like, it's not my personal memories. Those are for me and my family and my friends, mm-hmm. but like I share those intimate thoughts. And I think that's what social media is really, for me, very powerful for creative people anyway.
Yeah, I think I struggle with the idea of putting my. I don't do many things. I do Instagram. I don't really do anything else. Because it's fairly new to me. Like when I started making work or started thinking about what I'm doing now, none of these things were there. None of these things really existed, as they didn't for David or a lot of other people. And so I still haven't really felt like it was appropriate for me because of the fact that I don't know, there's this kind of physicality to the work I do or the way I work that doesn't really, for me, come through on a screen this big in a square. That's not to say that it can't, and you know, I have no problem with other people posting stuff, but it's just like I guess there's a little bit of superstition there as well about it's like, you know,
the I think kind superstition of,
it's, yeah.
There's a lot of like superstition in that thing. I totally understand that.
Bad juju.
Bad juju.
You don't leave your, you know, you don't leave your bits lying around. I guess it's something of intimacy as well. To me it's like flashing at everyone every day. Look what I'm doing. Yeah. I've never felt that.
It's such a
compulsion.
West African thing, I think.
I think it's that, and I think it's also generational because it's like, if I don't post for like 3 weeks, people are like, are you okay? Are you alive? Is ghetto gastro still a thing? So it's interesting, like, being able, but I always joke with you and say, like, you move like a drug dealer on the internet. You don't know when or where or how. It's like, you know, Russia, Mexico, in a 36-hour period, you're like, you know, what's really going on? And I also want to talk about identity and how does identity play a role in your work, if it does, or was it also a process of having to unlearn certain Western constructs to discover your aesthetic or create the aesthetic in your work?
I think as creative people are always struggling with identity and who we are and what we're making. I just think that sometimes as people of color that becomes like the only thing that becomes discussed, and it's irritating. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course that's there, but it's, you know, somehow becomes this kind of foreground. But at the same time, I don't want to dismiss it because it's very, very important. It is part of the kind of emergence of the moment, but creatively as a person, you know, the creative act is about a kind of reflection of yourself and your position in the world and your relationship to things. So I think it's continually about that. You can't even get away with it. Even if it's something, you know, like architecture or I think even other things, I think everything you do kind of is through that lens of that experience. And for me, architecture, I chose to practice a certain kind of architecture as I sort of matured in my ability to make things that for me would deal with a particular kind of engagement in the world. That engagement was about kind of the anger that allowed me to find my creativity. I call it anger now, or the kind of infuriation at the situation. And in a sense of, you know, what would you do? Well, okay, then spend your life dealing with that. And if you, you know, can spend your life dealing with that and it gets a bit better, then great. If it doesn't, then you've tried. But you can't complain about it.
I respect that.
Yeah. It's so woven into the fabric, as David's saying, of everything you do. And everything you make, who you are, what you've seen, what interests you. And I think as much as it's woven in, thinking very kind of literally about the act of working, the act of making, the act of getting up, getting yourself together, getting to a studio or to an office, having to think about what you're about to do, what you're putting out into the world, how your ideas are evolving. There's never an active moment of trying to get away from who you are and that you can't. It's being able to do that on your own terms and being able to speak about who you are, what you are, but also what you're doing and all the things that come into that, all the thoughts that come in, every inspiration, every aspect of that to come through, that there should never be a sense of feeling like there's only one point being made or one idea being explored. That's for me how I've always really thought in terms of a work ethic. Mm. One of my heroes of my entire life will always be Prince. Something stuck with me for my whole life was the idea that Prince got up and made music every day. and he made something every day, and that stuck with me from when I was a kid. Maybe that's why I work the way that I do. I go to a studio. If I don't do something that day, good or bad, I feel really angry with myself. If I do a painting and it's crap and I have to destroy it, I'm angry when I go home. But somehow that anger makes me go in the next day and try again. I remember Chris Ofili saying something to me about like the fact of like feeling like you were actually at war with something and not going home until you'd kind of fixed it. And he's like, you just sit there and just stare and you just let your face off with the thing until it's right. And I suspect it's the same for you.
Exactly.
It's the same for you. This kind of, you want to win. And that's a personal winning. It's nothing to do with what the world's going to see. It's feeling like you've actually done something. You've worked.
Yeah, I find that most of the work I do comes from a, I don't like to use the word selfishness, but everything I create or work on is really for me and for others like me. Mm-hmm. And it's like if other people mess with it, all right, cool. That's like a residual bonus. But I really just want to put things into the world that resonate with me.
So one of the things that immediately struck me about this talk is this kind of talk about that's common in a lot of immigrant communities of this generational thing of working for survival and then the idea of working as an artist. I can see it in my family. My grandparents worked in kind of like domestic work when they moved to Toronto. My father was an architect. I know that when he was growing up, they like threw away a guitar that he had like worked and bought for himself because like to be an artist was to be kind of like a delinquent in their eyes.
Right.
For me, my dad always wanted me to be an architect. That was like a respectable thing. And when I moved over here and started studying art, I think they were just like, my parents were just like, we don't really understand, but you seem like you're doing fine. And I really loved that moment when Lynette and John talk about these kind of like validating like moments where Lynette met the Queen and John worked with Martha Stewart when their parents were like, oh, okay, I guess this is kind of like serious now. Because I definitely had that when, you know, like telling my dad I'm going to be like doing something at the Tate or like, you know, working with the Serpentine and his ears kind of prick up and are like, oh, so I guess this is a thing now. I guess this is like a little bit legit.
Both Lynette and David spoke about this idea of like, it's not like there was another option. Like there was an imperative to make work or be creative in one form or another.
Yeah.
And so when Lynette talks about sort of her relationship with her parents, she's talking about a kind of like, well, I was doing it anyway because I could not, but I just didn't present it.
Yes, yes, definitely.
As like my career choice kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think I definitely feel the same, and I really relate to something that John Gray ends with saying, like, I really want to put things into the world that resonate with me. You know, it's not a selfish thing because, you know, like, as we know, like, personal is political. Like, if you're having this experience that's not being reflected to you in the world, then if you put it out, then somebody will probably also identify with it.
I feel like the images that one puts to those things are actually really important because then when one is organizing oneself, if you have those kinds of forms or images in mind. So, like, thinking about a web rather than a collective, you know, or thinking about, like, a mushroom rather than an umbrella. when you're talking about a definition, you're like, well, it's under everything rather than on top of everything.
Yeah.
Like those things actually make kind of a difference.
Yeah, they make a huge difference.
Maybe that's a really art world thing to say. I don't know. The image really matters.
No, but I think it is true. And I think that also like perspective in these situations is really important. Speaking from personal experience, like as somebody who is like queer, non-binary, a mixed race person of color, like I feel like a need to put my experience and my perspectives into the world because I know that like myself, like people who people are looking to have these kind of narratives represented in society to tell them that, you know, that's also a valid way of existing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Going back to what we were talking about before, like if this idea of catharsis could be transposed to the contemporary time and like an artwork does this idea of channeling emotional labor on behalf of the people that are watching, then similarly, when you're talking about making work, because you see a lack of spaces for self-recognition or self-presentation, then that is entirely sort of within the constitutive DNA of art. Yeah. No?
I mean, yeah, I really, I think I related a lot to what David Ajay said as well, you know, about this kind of thing of like work coming from a place of anger, or kind of like feeling that anger and, you know, sitting with it and working through it every day and something coming from it, maybe. Because it's also the only thing that you can do. It's something that you have like a deep need to do. It's something that, you know, like I became an artist because it was something, it was the only thing that I could do. It was the thing that I needed to do to kind of like work through how I was perceiving the world and how I could see myself and other people moving through it.
So both this idea that making art is or can be a kind of an inevitable imperative and the question of what the conditions around work are, like how one works, bring with it, of course, the question of what work do we do when we don't necessarily know that we're doing it or when we're not looking. And our next episode in this series will address just that.
Great.
We're calling it Dreamworks. And we were inspired by something that architectural historian Beatriz Colomina said while she was lying in an outdoor bed at the Serpentine.
Several years ago, it was, I think, 2012, I read in the New York Times, no, in the Wall Street Journal, of all places, that 80% of young people in New York, of young professionals, were working in bed. And I thought, that's amazing, because, you know, this is actually something that, at a certain point, was more authors, writers, creative people like Matisse or Proust used to work in bed, Truman Capote works in bed. And now it's like everybody is an artist or a producer of some kind, and we all want to work in bed, right? Or at least 80% of people in New York seem to be working in bed.
Bed, dreams and sleep. Those are the topics of our next episode, and we're looking at how they relate to work.
The Serpentine Podcast. On work.
Thank you for listening to episode 5 of the Serpentine Podcast on Work. I've been your host, Victoria Sin. You can listen to the whole series at radio.serpentinegalleries.org or subscribe with your podcast provider. The Serpentine Podcast on Work is curated by Lucia Pietrusti and Kay Watson. We were produced by Jesse Lawson and Jack Howson from Reduced Listening with sound design by Dane Law. But just before we go, we couldn't make it through a whole podcast on artists and work without observing one in the moment of making, doing, creating, and performing. Anna Imhoff's work has been described as meditations on contemporary power structures. At the marathon, she performed this song from her work, Faust, which she conceived for the German Pavilion at the 2017 Venice Biennale, which won the Golden Lion.
Universal.
rabbits around. I'm universal, lovesick. But I know we're meant to blow our minds. I'm in love with all of you. Let's find brand new gods here.
Let's find rest.